Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. I think that because of the weather, I was giving people a couple more minutes to get here, although it certainly is rather mild compared to what we might have expected. I think the roads in many parts of the community are rather slick. And in fact, one of our speakers has not made it here, and I'm guessing because she's coming from the far reaches. That might be the reason, but not to fear, here we are. I did want to make a couple of announcements. Excuse me while I get my notes. Many of you know that I also run with Colleen the Institute for Retired Professionals, and I like to make you aware of the programs coming up because we can't fit everything into TMR. So, actually this afternoon, Greg Tripoli from the OHA is going to be speaking. Doing basically the talk that he did for us a little bit ago about our entrepreneurial history. But coming up in 2 weeks, we have the outreach coordinator from the Veterans Administration Hospital talking about VA care and what's happening now. If you missed James Cody when he was here, you might want to check out the Institute for Retired Professionals in 2 weeks. It'll be a slightly different take, even if you did hear that. There's certainly a lot going on, and it is a big issue. In March, the first Thursday in March, we will be talking with Catherine Bertini. Catherine Bertini has been a speaker here in the past. You know her illustrious background with the World Food Program. She's the head of the International Relations Department at SU right now, but she still has her hands in things at the UN, at the Gates Foundation, and all over. So she will be talking about the issue of hunger and poverty from, of course, her very knowledgeable global perspective. And on March 17th at IRP, we will be talking with Judge Joseph Fahey, and it's sort of a holiday program, March 17th being. Thank you. With the life of James McGuire. So you might want to make sure that your friends come to that IRP at noon. And again, you don't have to be totally retired. You could be semi-retired or planning to retire someday. And that is that's why I go on our university college website. Next week here at the roundtable, we will be hosting Kathy Ricito, excuse me, former TMR member who is the newly appointed CEO of St. Joseph's Hospital. So lots going on there, so be here. This morning, as you know, we're talking about the issue of redistricting, which is very topical because, as we know, the census was completed and is going to spur some changes. To introduce today's program, I asked Joan Christensen, it was the only way I could get her to get here on time, is by asking her to do an introduction, because I don't think I've had the opportunity since she retired. She's a retiree now, from 20 years in the Assembly, over 25 years in public service, and we all owe her, especially those of us who live in what was Joan's Assembly, State Assembly District, a great debt of gratitude for all of her hard work and representation over the past, again, 20 more years in the city and the state. So yay for Joan Christensen, and if you would come up and introduce today's topic.
Thank you. Good morning. Good morning. As a former legislator, you know all people, or most people in elected office, tend to ramble on and on and on and on and on. And I have been seated in the audience when the introductions almost seem to outlast the actual speakers. Today, however, I have been asked to stretch. So I will refer to my notes somewhat, but if you see me pacing around here and watching the door, it's because I'm hoping that Mary comes in and the substitute hitter can resume her seat in the audience and stop shuffling the papers, as Grant is doing as well. So once again, good morning. We're talking about redistricting by the numbers. On the surface, the calculus for redistricting should seem simple enough and not very complex. Take the population of the state, 19.5 million people, divide by the number of state senate districts, 62, and 150 assembly districts, and voila, that determines the number of constituents per district, give or take 5%. But the districts are required to be contiguous and cannot disenfranchise a linguistic or ethnic group. The final numbers will not be out until April, but a few things are already clear. Minorities are moving to Long Island and Westchester, while upstate districts are losing population. Add to that the passage of a state law forbidding prison-based gerrymandering and new rules from the Supreme Court about how states can use the Voting Rights Act to draw districts, and it appears that upstate will have to consolidate or withdraw several. They're going to have to look at those numbers again. Probably we'll lose a district, and it'll go to the New York City. Now, Senator Velasky and Gennaris have sponsored a nonpartisan redistricting bill which would establish an independent 11-member citizen reapportionment committee to propose, with approval by the state legislature, district boundaries for Congress, state Senate, and the assembly districts every 10 years following the U.S. Senate. It eliminates the Legislative Task Force on Demographic Research and Reapportionment. At a December 14th meeting of the Legislative Task Force on Redistricting, good governance groups called for just such an independent commission, but believed it would have to be created before April 1st in order to have the time to do the work they had to do, and that the bill would have to pass by February 1st. Now, it's still possible, but it's a little more of an issue today than it was last December because the Senate has gone Republican. Grant Reher and Mary Claire Hatch Pinello are at TMR to help unravel the complexities of redistricting. I hope Mary makes it. Grant earned his PhD from Yale University. He's an associate professor of political science at Syracuse University. His research and teaching interests focus on American politics, the democratic process, legislative politics, the political role of the Internet. Grant often appears on PBS, radio, and television, as well as in the Syracuse newspapers, and has authored several books. From 1995 to 97, he was a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Scholar in Health Policy Research at the University of Michigan. Professor Reher is a familiar face to TMR, having served as both a panelist and a moderator at several of our sessions. I'm going to introduce Mary, and then I know you're not Mary, but on the outside chance that she comes, and then I'll let you explain a little bit about yourself, our pitch hitter. Mary Claire Hatch Pinello is the advocacy chairman for the Greater Syracuse League of Women Voters. She is currently the executive director at Before and After School Care on Location. She was educated at the State University of Binghamton, the State University of New York College at Cortland, and the State University College at Cortland. But until she makes it here today, our pitch hitter is
Ray Rofeld. I'm the program chair for the Syracuse Metropolitan League of Women Voters, past president, and I have somewhat prepared, but not really, because I never really thought I'd have to do this, but I can tell you the background and the league's position on this.
Thank you very much. And now let's welcome Grant and Ray.
Well, the League of Women Voters has been working on this issue for quite a number of years. And there are several other organizations who have worked together, NYPIRG and the Brennan Center, Common Cause, and the Citizen Union of the city of New York. And so the positions have come together, but basically in New York State we have a very, well, let's put it this way, our districts do not necessarily match the guidelines that are given for census districts, the compactness, the equivalent size, and so forth. And part of the reason is that the legislators have been very much involved in redistricting, and so they're sort of looking at their own districts and trying to make them work for the legislators. I wish I could show you this, if those of you who can see it. It's something that looks like a crab or maybe a vulture, but it represents the shape of at least one district. I think that picture speaks well for the reason behind this push to reform redistricting. So I think Grant is going to get into some of the reasons. I may pitch in later, but I do want to let you know that the league, along with the other organizations, has produced a good deal of material that lays out very thoroughly what some of the problems are with redistricting. As you know, we have to redistrict every 10 years, but we hope that it doesn't always have to be far from the idea of one person, one vote. And if you look at the League of Women Voters of New York State website, you can find, and I believe it's pretty near the top of the issues that they discuss, you can find documents on redistricting. And that website is www.lwvnys.org.
Or Google League of Women Voters.
Or Google it, yes, League of Women Voters of New York State, because there are national and also local websites, but it's the state website that has most of the material. And so you will be able to fill yourselves in on anything you might miss today. Grant?
I'm going to borrow this one. I've been sitting here trying to remember the exact quote from John Stuart Mill that I will garble now, but it's something to the effect of, if you, he who doesn't know the other side's case doesn't know much of his own. And we'll prove this here, because I'm going to try to give you briefly the case, and then my role was to give you second thoughts about the case. So I didn't want to lead with that, but I'll try to give you the case here. First, I just say, I really like the fact that this was on the front of the handouts. You come up and look at it later, but this is the original gerrymander from 1812. It actually was Gary originally. This was Elbridge Gary, governor of Massachusetts, created these districts through the legislature, and this was one that was, I believe, just north of Boston. It goes, there's Marblehead is down here, and it goes up around like this, and it's so the paper. The newspaper created this cartoon of it, and someone said, well, it looks like a salamander, and then someone said, well, it's a gerrymander, so, and then it's become gerrymander. So that basically is the problem in a nutshell. I think that the League and other reformers like Blair Horner and other groups have been arguing for and criticizing the New York State legislature, New York State political process for in the way that they draw their districts. Brief historical background on this that might be relevant to this. And this The Constitution is very vague about districting. The clause on this really just refers to the number of congressional districts and the fact that they'll be based on a decennial census. Beyond that, there isn't much to say about it. And the Supreme Court, over the years, has treated districting up until the early 60s as something that it put into what it called the political category, which means that they weren't going to have much to say about this. And so state legislatures pretty much and states pretty much created these districts as they saw fit. Now, there were two famous cases in the early 60s that changed all that, Baker versus Carr, Reynolds versus Sims. The first one established the idea that the Supreme Court would intervene and that there was a basic concept of one person, one vote in these districts, both at the congressional level and at the state level. And then Reynolds' case actually started delineating what those standards should be. The only other thing that the court's really gotten involved in since then is this question of race in districts, and that comes from the Voting Rights Act and the different versions of the Voting Rights Act. But the basic gist of this is the original thought was you'd want to actively create minority representation where you could because it had been historically worked against. But then the Supreme Court has come back and rethought that and restricted the use of race in this, and so that race can be a factor, but it can't be the predominant factor or the driving factor. And so that's otherwise, though, the Supreme Court has explicitly recognized that political considerations and looking at political advantage is A-okay. That's part of the process, and that's the way it's going to work. But basically, the gist here, what's been going on in New York, I'll try to summarize what I think are the strongest arguments for it. You've got, first of all, a stretching of the boundaries of trying to keep the boundaries in terms of logic, not the actual boundaries being drawn, but a stretching of the idea of keeping these districts equal size. And so that in New York, the deviation between the smaller districts and the larger districts is up around 10% now, where the target is more around 1%. So there's some playing around with these districts, and they're not all the same size. Now, that wouldn't be a problem in and of itself until you start looking at how these districts are being varied that way. And so what you see is that, and this goes back to the last couple times this was done, where you had a Republican-controlled Senate and a Democrat-controlled Assembly, but Assembly districts, the smaller districts were in the democratically controlled areas, and if you think about this for a second, that gives you more of them. And then the more highly populated districts were in Republican-controlled. Flip it around the other way for the Senate. And the idea here is that you're trying to sort of pack your party seats in the legislature by having more numerous districts with fewer people in them versus smaller number of districts, larger people in them. The other level of the problem is the way these actual districts are drawn. And so Blair Horner and the League of Women Voters and others have this, and this is what you would have seen on the PowerPoint, these really wonderfully bizarre Rorschach-looking shapes for political districts that you can put all sorts of interesting names on. The favorite one, I think, of Blair and others is Abraham Lincoln riding a vacuum cleaner. And it took me a minute to see that, and actually it's exactly what it looks like. It's a good one. It's a good label. But the problem is here that these are drawn in some bizarre way, and they're drawn for political advantage. Concern about this is obviously a democratic one. Is this democratic? Is this the way that we want to have our districts set out in a state? Is this really what political representation should look like? And is this the process to do it? But the other one, I think, the deeper one is that it changes the way, according to the folks that are concerned about this, it changes the way the legislature functions. That it sets up incentives and it sets up cultures that do not serve us well. And that's a more complicated thing, and I'll gloss over that for now. But that is my understanding of the gist of this argument, and it makes sense. Then the question becomes, what do you do about it? And so the proposal that is on the table is to have some sort of independent commission that will be non-political and that presumably will carry more wisdom into this process. And the way to have that commission then have some teeth is the idea that the recommendations that this commission would make have to be either accepted or rejected in total by the legislature or some version of that. There's different flavors of this process that have been put forward, but that's the gist of it. And so that is basically, I think, the story that I then want to throw some caveats onto, and that's what I'll do now, and then we can see where we want to go with questions. So Now this is the part that I was going to say. My role here is to throw out some second thoughts, not to engage in a point-counterpoint debate. I'm not dumb enough to try to stand here or sit here before a group like this and convince you that the system is just ducky the way it is. I know this group well enough to know that wouldn't work. And I don't believe that in any case. So let me start with what I agree with here. I am in heated agreement on the idea of evening out the population sizes of the districts. And I'm also in heated agreement, and this is something that is in the league's materials that I didn't mention before, that this year, that now, is the time to make this kind of change. I'm in heated agreement with that, too, because I think that the opportunities for reform are high in New York State right now, higher perhaps than they've ever been, for at least three political reasons. The first is that the public, I think, in this last election cycle has demonstrated that it wants some kind of serious reform. It certainly has demonstrated that in the past, but I think you could argue that that level of frustration and clearness of message was higher this time than it has ever been before. You can just think about the whole phenomenon of Carl Paladino, some of the changes at the other down ballot races, the general climate. It's clear to me that, and the election of Andrew Cuomo and the way that he framed his campaign, all say that to me. Second, this new governor and the new majority in the Senate have a clear interest in delivering on important things. They know that, and we seem to have elected them with that idea in mind. And then the third one is that political reform does not cost a lot of money. So it's something important that this new governor and this new majority can deliver on that doesn't involve spending money, because spending money right now seems to be off the table. No big new programs are going to be coming forward anytime soon. So I think this is the time to do this. But I do have some questions, and they take two forms. They take the form of who and what. So first, who? Who will be on this commission? Okay. This brings up, I think, some deep questions about the fundamental nature of democracy and its relationship to expertise. So one idea, for example, in constituting this commission that I have heard and some people have put forward is that retired judges should make up this commission. Now, I've encountered some judges in the 20 years that I've been living in this area that I would not want to be doing this, quite frankly. And I have nothing against judges as a group. I'd have the same reaction if you were to tell me that doctors should be doing this, or heaven forbid, political scientists should be the only ones doing this. Okay, there are some kinds of experts and expertise that do bear on this task. Demographers, geographers, political scientists, those with some prior experience advising people on this. But the ultimate judgment calls that have to be made here involve a certain kind of difficult value trade-off that nobody has a monopoly on in terms of wisdom. And so the commission, I think, has to be very diverse in all respects, across income, across class, across occupation. It can't just be different flavors of what the British would call the great and the good. Okay, so that is one concern I have right off the bat. Who's on this commission? Second, what should they draw? And here it gets a lot stickier. What do you prioritize in the drawing of the districts? Geographic contiguousness? I'll come back to that one in a minute. But first, let's take the other one that's in the League of Women Voters values, and it's been put forward by Blair Horner and others, and that is competitiveness of elections. That is, that we should draw these districts so that the elections are closer. Okay. It seems plausible on its face, but I see two problems here. The first one is a philosophical but a real one. If you emphasize competitiveness as some kind of a priori goal going in, you're doing precisely what you are faulting the present system of doing. That is, you are reasoning backward from the kind of electoral outcome that you want to see. So in this case, you want the outcome to be close. That is not necessarily more democratic with a small d, in part because of the second problem. If, and it's a big if, but if you are able to create a whole bunch of these competitive districts, and I think given the demographics of the state of New York, your ability to do this is going to be limited beyond tinkering with the margins. But if you are able to do this, you are going to make the state's entire representational system more homogeneous and middle of the road. And that, again, is not necessarily more democratic with a small d. Let's just think about this. In our state right now, we've got lots of people who are on the left, and we've got lots of people who are on the right. At least the way the present system works, a staunch conservative who's living in a solidly liberal Democratic with a capital D district knows that somewhere in the state a representative is going to be taking his or her views to Albany and vice versa. If you create a bunch of really competitive districts, that's going to be less the case. And so this brings up the ultimate problem here, and this is the real sticking point that no solution that is going to limit itself to single-member districts can solve. And that is that you are still tying political representation to geography. Okay. This is going to make it difficult no matter what you do. So let's say, again, you want contiguous and compact as your main value. Well, not all the relevant possible factors for representation that we might want to cluster follow and fall along compact, contiguous geographic lines. Let's just take some examples. It may make sense from the perspective of the overall political representation of the system to have a more urban district and a suburban district and a rural district. Well, the suburban district is necessarily going to look like a claw, is one of the titles of one of these funny-looking districts, or a donut. The rural district is going to wander off into all sorts of different shapes. You can't avoid it. And those different districts also are likely to tilt one way or another regarding party and partisanship. It's the way that demographics work. So here's the thing that I would end with. I would end with this humble, radical third alternative for this. And this one's not on anyone's agenda, so don't worry. Don't get scared. But it's what I would do. Break some of the bounds of geography and representation and open up the representational process to different interests and different views that are not necessarily geographically rooted. How do you do this? Well, the details of that would be for another Thursday morning roundtable. But basically what I would suggest here is moving to a larger multi-member district system in which voters cast a single vote that ranks several different candidates, and then those votes are subjected to a system of multiple counts that allows the individual citizen to vote for more marginal candidates without wasting their vote. And the fancy name for this is called the single transferable vote, STV. And the citizens in British Columbia, the crazy Canadians, the citizens in British Columbia almost went for this in their elections, and they did that thanks to a citizens' commission that had been established to rethink their electoral system because they weren't satisfied with it. They took a whole bunch of citizens from all different walks of life and gave them the incentives and the facilities to think about this for an entire year and deliberate on it and hear the testimony of experts. And they came up with their recommendation after looking at all the alternatives out there of the single transferable vote. And then they put that back to the citizens of British Columbia. They almost voted for it. It narrowly was defeated. If you look at, in terms of websites, if you were to Google, say, British Columbia single transferable vote, you'll find some of the websites that are still around on this. And one of them has this really clever, handy little 15-minute cartoon video which explains the system. The knock on this and the knock of other types of systems like this is that citizens won't understand them. They're too complicated and they won't have trust in them. I don't think that's the case. I think that's a hurdle that can be overcome. But that's what I would end with, because I think as long as you tie one representative to some kind of defined geographical district, you are going to be creating these kinds of problems and you cannot solve them. So that's where I would leave it.
I think I'll vote for that. Well, let me ask a question that's maybe related to that idea. Is first of all, I think Joan Christensen in her introduction said we have 150 assembly districts and 62 Senate districts. Do we need that many? And do you have any idea, Grant, how we stack up with other states as to, number of representatives per population?
actually 150 for the lower house is kind of a typical number. And so, you know, the thing about New York is we are still, even though we're losing population or other states are gaining it faster, we're going to lose congressional district seats in light of that this time around. We're still a big state. And so the districts here in New York are pretty big. I mean, a state Senate district is pretty big. And so population-wise, in addition to geography in some cases. And so I wouldn't be advocating for making them any smaller or cutting down the number of them. I believe that the reason why we have 62 in the state Senate is goes back to this kind of pre-Baker day, because, you know, it reflects the number of counties. So, I mean, I'll just take to go back to that. The worst example of this pre-Baker was in the state of Connecticut. The House there had a system where it was all based on towns and villages, because in New England, towns and villages are very, very important politically. And the rule there was that each town, each incorporated town or village got one, at least one representative in the state house, but no more than two. So you had Union, Connecticut, which had a population of about 160, sent one person to Hartford. The city of Hartford, which was enormous compared to the town of Union, sent two. So there was an obviously imbalance there that favored rural. And there was a huge actual, I'm going off a little bit on a tangent, but I think it's an important piece of political history. There was a huge, at the state level, shift in policy toward more urban and suburban concerns and interests at the state level after those reapportionments were done, because prior to that point, rural concerns tended to dominate in the state legislature because they were overrepresented. But I think in terms of the numbers, and someone shot their hand. Ed, you want to comment on that? I think, but oh, okay. But I think we're pretty good in terms of total number, and we're not like New Hampshire, who's got this crazy 400 member state lower house. So.
Okay. We do have in the audience a number of past elected officials or people who have run for office, and if any of you have any personal experience or anecdotes, we'd like to hear them.
No anecdotes from me. But I did have some experience on the county level of being on a committee, but really since I was the Democrat and it was a Republican majority, we just nodded periodically. Anyway, the more important question I have is, in terms of numbers, really goes to size of the districts you're going to end up with. So you changed and made the state Senate 25 folks instead of 62. You have bigger districts. I think when you have bigger districts, you obviously have more geography, more folks for constituent service, et cetera. Is there a part in here that deals with, do we look for full-time versus part-time? And people like to say that the Assembly, I guess even the Senate, are supposed to be part-time roles. Is that realistic? And obviously some people make it full-time anyway. But is that a value that we're trying to figure out, and that would go into larger or less? I know the county legislature here is downsizing again, went from 24 to 19, and now it's going to 17. So they're obviously getting larger district-wise that way. But gerrymandering seems to be the wave of the past and the future.
No, I don't believe we do. I think the job has grown in both in terms of population, but also in terms of the complexity of issues. And so more people spend more time. Technically, I think the bodies are part-time, but it doesn't seem that way from the amount of time they spend. I think it's interesting to note that, you know, we're mostly thinking now of the redistricting within the state. But we also reapportion congressional representatives, and we will lose probably two. That's a relatively new thing. Until 1910, after the census, if there were more people, they added more seats in Congress. And then there was a change, and they kept the same number of seats in Congress and just divided them differently among the states. That probably had to do with the fact that there were more people living in cities than in the rural areas, and there was it was a period of considerable nativism. Some people didn't like a lot of new immigrants filling up the cities and getting more votes, and so, but for whatever reason, that one was the case. So just think how many members we would have if we've never changed that in Congress.
Quick thing, I don't know if you can see my knee jerking under the table. I love this question because it brings up something I'm just really agitated about. It drives me crazy when I read in the paper or I hear someone say about the New York State Legislature that it is a part-time job. If I can just do one thing today, I would like to kill that myth. It is not a part-time job. Only if you're not doing it well is it a part-time job. Maybe the reason why it drives me so crazy is because it reminds me of something that people say about professors. You're only in the classroom for a few hours a week. What do you do with the rest of your time? When in reality, most of us work about 50 hours a week. So you have to study issues. The constituent work, as you pointed out already, is huge. You have to show up at every single doggone thing that someone wants to invite you to. Joan can tell you all about that. And so some people take to that more than others, but it is a full-time job, and I think that extends down even to other states where it even is supposedly more explicit. I spent a lot of time studying the Vermont legislature, which is more distinctively part-time, but even there, members of the House in the state of Vermont who really took their jobs seriously, that was their primary job. The way I've always said this is it's a full-time job that pays a part-time salary. And the New York State Legislature pays a full-time salary, and I think it should. I personally, to go off on that tangent, I would raise their salaries. That idea is going nowhere. But I would raise their salaries and cut out the Lulu would be the way that I would reform that particular one.
There's a tendency to think of issues such as this in a rather parochial point of view, state by state and so on. Can you give some examples, I guess you'd call them successful cases, of states which have adopted this some solutions that would make sense here in New York State?
There are several states that have relatively recently changed their way of doing this. I guess the one that's held up most often is Iowa. Generally, I would say the reforms involve, you know, I think Grant made this point before, who is it that makes these decisions? If you're going to change the commission or the group that makes, that redistricts, who makes the decision and how? And in New York, we've argued that too often there are working legislators who get on the commissions and who have an interest, a more personal interest, let us say, in the nature of the district. Well, in Iowa and some other states, they have a way of developing a pool of nominees, and those nominees cannot be legislators or cannot usually be elected officials for a certain amount of time in the past. And then it seems to me that no matter how you do it, you can't get away from having parties involved and trying to equalize the strength of all the parties. And so there's usually some person on the commission who's considered a tiebreaker, And it's usually a judge, but the commission actually chooses its own chair, and as I say, it's chosen by another group from a pool of nominees. So, as you probably, I think it was mentioned that Dave Valesky had sponsored a redistricting commission last year, which did get approved by the Senate, but not by the Assembly. And I don't know if somebody recalls the details of that, but it did provide for the commission not to be elected officials, and it provided a way for them to be nominated so that it wasn't so tightly controlled by the parties.
One of the other things, just to add really quickly, is to look at the other states. Again, caveat here, most of the states, I think, I don't have the list in front of me, do not have the kind of demographic diversity and geographical complexity that New York has. That's one of the things that makes our legislature have the difficulties that it has. It is, I think, one of the hardest states in the country to govern for reasons that have nothing to do with what the legislators are doing with their time in Albany. And so those are just structural problems. And I think that would make this process, again, equally difficult and problematic because Iowa, to take that example, doesn't have the kind of dramatic demographic diversity that's tied to geography that the state of New York has. You're really just looking at a few handful of states that look like us that have these issues, California, New York, the big difficult ones, and that complicates the process.
I will say that I this past week looked at Senator Valesky's website and the bill that he had sponsored or co-sponsored that's linked to his website now if you'd like to go there and also indicate an interest in redistricting. And it did go, there was a structure where there would be 40 nominees. I'm not sure who makes the nominations, but, and there were requirements that they be diverse as far as party and other elements. Ultimately, there would be a commission of 11 members, no more than four representatives of any given party. They would come up with up to three proposals, and ultimately, though, the legislature would have the say on approving the plan, the ultimate plan. So I'm not sure if the detail of the devil there is in the details of not just the composition of the commission, but then the plan that's ultimately approved. But you know, as you say, it seems as though now is the time that would be ripe for some kind of reform. And I have a question over down this way that we will get to.
Thank you. It's not a question, but a comment. Mayor Koch's commission, or I don't know if that's what you want to call it, I think it was New York Uprising last fall before election time. He got many of our legislators and candidates for the legislature to sign a pledge that they would support non-district or nonpartisan redistricting. And I think it behooves us to check and make sure our representative signed that pledge and follow up and see what he or she is doing with this. Do they still support this? Or will they support some other method of redistricting the state? And I have one more other comment. The League is going to be sponsoring the movie Gerrymandering. It's a documentary on the issue. It has good reviews. You can Google it on the net. It's also witty, I understand. I haven't seen it. I've seen clips of it. So how redistricting can be witty is a little beyond me. But we will be sponsoring that at the Palace Theater on March 27th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that's a Sunday. and we hope to see some of you there.
And that looks at several states so that you get some comparison.
Okay. Do you have anything that you would like to add, Joan? Come on. There you go.
I am very cautious of what Ed Koch is doing, because when I looked at the makeup of his commission, there was only one woman and there was no upstate representative. And I feel that it's not representative of our interest when he doesn't even allow an upstate member to be on the commission. And I've taken him to task on that. And although we have a very friendly correspondence going back and forth, I still believe that he does a disservice when he tells me that former governors will be the voice of upstate. I just don't believe that's true. I'd rather have one of our own representatives. The other problem that I see as I watched redistricting, and I've been through it twice. The first time I was very naive. I didn't know what was going on, and I was very trusting. And I just thought it would work out. And it did. I was shifted over and given all of Salina and the part of the city that I won big and was taken away from me. But I was told I would be protected. And that's the other part of the issue. You have conversations with the leadership, and you talk about how the redistricting will affect you, and there is some consideration given to that. The 10 years later, there were several of us who had not been supportive of the leadership of the assembly, and were looking for a change. And at least three of us found ourselves in districts where we would be running against an incumbent as well, because the district lines had been redrawn, so we would be in districts with an incumbent. Two incumbents in one district running for office. And finally, what surprised me the most was that congressional leaders would come back to the assembly, many of them former assembly members, to have conversations with leadership about redistricting. And for the first time ever, I saw congressmen and congresspeople hiring lobbyists to advocate for their position. I'm very cautious now, as I've seen the process unfold, of when there was legislative approval of nominees. I would like to think that's a good way to go, and in many cases it is. But often it is the very body that approves that is appointing, and so there may be some problems there. And as former judges, I know that many of those judges are appointed by the state legislature. So where's the trust?
We have a question. I was just going to ask, has anyone tried computing capabilities that there are, and you mentioned geographers. Of course, it's, you know, what you put in, what you get out. Has anyone tried just doing a strict computer-generated redistricting, just to see for fun, maybe putting in some different considerations as far as, you know, numbers and having to put in some demographics so that we're being fair, to see if that would work or at least generate some options?
That's a good question. I think the answer is yes. I mean, I think that, and I'm sort of working from memory here, but I think that in a lot of these instances, that's the first cut. You put the parameters into the computer and the program, and you look at what you get back, and then you run that up against common sense, and because the computer doesn't know some of the things that you'd want to look at if you're thinking about a town and what you know about a town. So I think the answer is yes to that, though.
If not, maybe we could look at that at some university.
I think you're going to take that 50-hour week and make it 60. The
In the past, when the Republicans truly had control of the Senate and the Democrats of the Assembly, we used to hear that the Senate protected the Republicans throughout the state, and the Assembly protected the Democrats. How did that work if you had one committee?
Well, it has to be approved. You mean how would it work in the future? This is a case of bargaining like any other piece of legislation. So this is kind of the deal they each made with each other. We'll draw the Senate districts this way and the Assembly districts this way. So you had each of them kind of agreeing to a system that worked against, in a sense, their party's interests in the other house so they could get what they want. I mean, this is classic log rolling for two parties. So that's the way I think the system worked. So it would have been, I'm not arguing, I want to make sure I'm not making a partisan argument here. It would have been an interesting thing to watch had the legislature been all of one party this time. Could have been really, if we would have done traditional districting, it could have been really awful. But you could argue that at least there's some kind of check on this, because even though you're going to play with these things, you've got to play with them in both directions. But that's my understanding of the way it has worked. It was a deal.
Okay. Here's somebody with some experience in the state legislature.
Well, good morning. Like Joan, I've been through a couple of the redistricting wars, and you're absolutely right. That's how it works. You get to the table, and it doesn't matter where it starts. When you get to the table, the Assembly tries to protect its own. The Senate tries to protect its own. I don't know that it's classic log rolling, but it's classic something at the end of the day. And you get these districts that are aesthetically displeasing. I understand that. But I'm wondering, we've been talking a lot about partisanship and the shape of districts, but it seems to me one of the other considerations might be toward effective governance. And the reason I raise that is that in a state like ours, where legislators from New York City, which tends to be sort of a one-party city, tend to have a singular view. And irrespective of how you draw those districts will not be competitive at the end of the day. Whereas upstate, right, the upstate areas, as you make them more competitive, you make your legislators potentially less effective and always kind of looking over their shoulder. Joan's example was a terrific example of what happens if you fall to the wrong side of leadership or if you just fall to the wrong side of an issue. If you have a district that's split in its interest between several different interests, you can get a legislator who's actually paralyzed and thus at a disadvantage, let's say, to other parts of the state or to leadership that might cohere from one part of the state or another part of the state. So I think the focus on elections is very important. I'm not trying to diminish that at all. But it seems to me that it might be an equally important discussion to talk about the effectiveness of governance and that line then perhaps the desirability of some coherence of interest within a district.
For those of you who don't know, Bob Herz was a staffer to Senator Lombardi for a few years, several years, many years, centuries. Okay.
I want to jump in on that and follow up on that because it goes back to the argument that I wanted to make about another way to do this. It fits exactly what you're saying. If you were to go to this other system of having larger districts with multiple members that were elected through some kind of system where you could cast, vote, rank different people, the experience on this is clear from other places. You will generate people who will go to the legislature and be elected on much more specific, concrete platforms that they can then articulate in the legislature and don't have to, as you say, always be looking over your shoulder. So just think about this for a minute. If you had a district that elected 8 people, you might have one of those folks whose constituency is not tied to a particular area of geography, but is more driven by people with, let's say, environmental interests. And so that's the environmental legislator. You might have another that's business, concerned about maybe the tax cutter goes there, okay? And then they go to the legislature, and their constituency in terms of their votes is a particular set of beliefs and interests that can hold that person much more accountable than an entire district. Lastly, to think about this. Think about a typical, and there's some folks from the paper here, I think they'll appreciate this. You're sitting down with a candidate during an election season. You say, how are you going to deal with the financial problem? We've got to cut spending. Okay, fine. What are we going to cut? Well, we have to look at the whole process, top to bottom. We have to think about everything. Okay, does that mean that you're going to make significant cuts in Medicaid? Well, first we've got to get the waste out of the process, and then we'll take another look at it. All right, you could have under this case someone that actually is willing to say, look, I think we need to cut spending, and here's where we need to cut it, here, here, and here, and I'm running on that platform. You could have then enough people in a district that might say, you know what, that makes sense. That person's going to lose the folks that are worried about those cuts and what kind of spending, but you're going to have, I think, a more robust, authentic, meaningful political dialogue in that area, and then you'll have a more robust, meaningful system of representation when you get to the legislature. That's what I would argue.
Thank you. Obviously, no answers here, but an issue that we really need to stay on top of if we agree that there's some room for change. I want to remind everybody about the League of Women Voters website where you'll find more information, the WCNY website where you can find this podcast next week or you can listen on Sunday. And I'm even going to give a plug for the WRVO website where you will hear Grant Rear and the Campbell Conversations.
Can I give a further plug? The guest this week, this Friday, it's Friday at noon, Saturday's at 4. My guest this week is going to be the president of the Jordan Elbridge School Board.
Oh, okay. Good one. I want to thank Ray Rofield for pitch hitting for the League of Women Voters and Professor Grant Rear. Thank you.